Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Ezekiel chapter 5, which I will entitle Jerusalem Will Be Destroyed. Our context is this. Ezekiel has been prophesying. He has been told to lie on his side for 390 days, his left side, to symbolize judgment against the northern kingdom of Israel. Then he was told to lie on his right side for 40 days to symbolize judgment against Judah. He was doing this in his house. He was near the river Kabar, which is a river that connects the Euphrates and Tigris rivers in present-day eastern Syria. He, of course, has been taken captive to Babylon in 597 B.C. He's prophesying now about 5 years later, about 592 or so. And so we take up the story here in verses 1 through 4 of Ezekiel 5. Yahweh is speaking. Now, son of man, take a sharp sword and use it as a barber's razor to shave your head and your beard. Then take a set of scales and divide up the hair. When the days of your siege come to an end, burn a third of the hair with fire inside the city. Take a third and strike it with the sword all around the city, and scatter a third to the wind. For I will pursue them with drawn sword. But take a few strands of hair and tuck them away in the folds of your garment. Again, take a few of these and throw them into the fire and burn them up. A fire will spread from there to the whole house of Israel. Now in verse 1, God refers to Ezekiel as son of man, and as I stated in several previous audios, the term son of man could either be given to make Ezekiel a type of Christ who called himself a son of man all the time, or it could be a term that makes Ezekiel humble because he's a great prophet, but he needs to remember that he's still just a human. He puts it on his pants one leg at a time, if you will. I prefer the former explanation that Ezekiel is considered a type of Christ. Ezekiel is to take a sharp sword. Now, this is referring, of course, to Nebuchadnezzar. Barnes says it's the avenging power of God, but Nebuchadnezzar is who God used for that avenging power, that power which is shortly to come upon Jerusalem in 586. Take the sharp sword and use it as a barber's razor. Now, some people debate whether this was literal or whether it was within a vision. In my humble opinion, it was literal because it could easily be done. It's not on the surface incredible. So Ezekiel is to take a barber's razor and he is supposed to shave his head. Now, the head symbolizes Jerusalem, as Barnes points out, and Jerusalem is to be shaved. Well, what does that mean? Well, shaving one's head was a sign of mourning or a sign of disgrace, as Barnes points out. Benson says baldness was a token of sorrow, but on the other hand, hair was considered an ornament. Well, Jerusalem is about to get shaved by Nebuchadnezzar. Now, not only was Ezekiel's head to be shaved, but also his beard. What does the beard symbolize? Well, in my opinion, the beard was merely another part of the hair of his head, and so it was not meant to mean anything separately. It's not meant to symbolize anything. However, the commentator Poole says as an option that the beard represented the common citizens as opposed to the nobility being represented by Ezekiel's head. I think that's a stretch. Poole mentions another option, that the beard represents the cities and towns around Jerusalem, whereas the head represented Jerusalem itself. Well, let's just take it as Judah. Jerusalem and the surrounding cities are going to get shaved by Babylon. Now, having the beard shaved among the Arabs was a big deal. Here's what Benson says. Among the Arabs, Benson is quoting another one of his commentators named Harmer, and this Harmer guy says, among the Arabs there cannot be a greater stamp of infamy than to cut off anyone's beard, and many among them would prefer death to this kind of punishment. And as they would think it a grievous calamity to lose it, so they carry things so far as to beg for the sake of it by your beard, by the life of your beard. Do. In like manner, some of the benedictions are, God preserve your blessed beard. God pour his blessings on your beard. And when they would express their value for a thing, they say, it is worth more than his beard. So beards were big deals, apparently, among the Arabs. And so if that cultural aspect carried over to the Jews here, it would be a big deal to have one's beard shaved. A disaster. At the end of verse 1, God tells Ezekiel, then take a set of scales and divide up the hair. Well, All the commentators agree that the scales are a symbol of God's justice. Barnes, Benson, and Poole, for example. So God's about to wreak his justice upon Jerusalem. He's about to shave Jerusalem. Shave her bald. God says, take these scales, divide up the hair. Now, what does the hair represent? Well, as Barnes and Poole say, the hair represents the population of Jerusalem. It could represent the population of Jerusalem in the outlying towns. That's a minor quibble. The point is, it's the people that are about to get whacked. And they're going to get whacked in three different ways. Justly, because the hair is divided up on the scales. Ezekiel's hair. Verse 2, when the days of your siege come to an end. That's referring to Ezekiel's symbolic siege when he lay on his side. First to the left and lay on his side. Secondly, to the right, 390 days on the left, 40 days on the right, the symbolic siege that was carried out in the previous chapter. Now, when he finished doing that siege, he's supposed to take the hair, which he shaved off his head, and burn a third of the hair with fire inside the city. Now, the city that's talked about there is talking about the city that Ezekiel had drawn on the clay tablet in the previous chapter. It was a symbolic siege carried out on that emblematic city, engraved on the clay tablet. So a third of the hair would be placed on that clay tablet and burnt, and then a third would be struck with a sword all around the city. Again, the city on the clay tablet. Ezekiel would take his hair and start whacking the hair with a sword, and then he would take the last third of his hair, throw it up into the air, and let it be scattered to the winds. Now, I don't know whether he took the hair outside of his house or just threw it up in his house. He very well could have taken it outside and thrown it up into the air. Well, let's just symbolize the symbolism here. There were three-thirds of the hair. The first hair represented the pestilence and plague that would occur inside the city in 586. That was the first third that was burnt on top of the city on the clay tablet. The second third that was whacked with a sword as the hair was carried all around that city on the tablet, that third represented all the people of Jerusalem who were killed outside of the city. And that might include members of the army of Jerusalem that sallied outside the city walls to try to protect against the Babylonians, as Adam Clark says, or as John Gill says, he could refer to those who fled out of Jerusalem when the city was broken up. They were pursued, overtaken, and cut off by the sword. We read that in Jeremiah 52, verses 7 and 8. Then the city was broken into, and all the men of war fled and went forth from the city at night by way of the gate between the two walls, which was by the king's garden. Though the Chaldeans were all around the city, the Chaldeans, of course, are the Babylonians, and they went by way of the Arabah, that's the valley that extends from the southern tip of the Sea of Galilee down to the Dead Sea, from the southern tip of the Dead Sea, all the way down to the Gulf of Aqaba, the tip of the Red Sea. And that's where Zedekiah was fleeing as he went south trying to get away. But the Chaldeans pursued Zedekiah the king and overtook Zedekiah in the plains of Jericho. That's confusing because Jericho's to the north, not to the south. But I'm assuming that the name Plains of Jericho referred to that Arabah Valley, and the name kind of extended all the way to the south of Jerusalem. And all of Zedekiah's army was scattered from him. So that could be what it is. The people of Jerusalem who were whacked outside the city. That's the second third. Now, the third third was scattered to the wind. That, of course, refers to the exiles who went to Babylon after the siege and destruction of Jerusalem was over in 586. Now, all this hair being destroyed, the population of Jerusalem destroyed in three different ways. How does hair refer to people? Well, it could refer to their levity and unsteadiness because hair is sort of unsteady. Is it waves back and forth on one's scalp, or the hair could refer to the beauty of a person. A woman's hair is her beauty. Men's hair makes them look handsome too. And so the people are said to be the beauty and ornament of the places where they lived. Well, whatever the symbolism, the hair is whacked, gone, burn up. In verse 3, God tells Ezekiel, take a few strands of hair and tuck them away in the folds of your garment. Now these are the very few Jews who managed to escape the preceding three calamities, the pestilence and plague, the first third of the hair getting destroyed outside of the city walls during the siege, the second third of the hair, and the third third of the hair, those taken in exile. There were some Jews that avoided all that. That is symbolized by the few strands of hair that were tucked away into the folds of Ezekiel's garments. Now, I mentioned that the third of hair represented the exiles who went off to Babylon, but we need to remember that a lot of people fled Jerusalem and probably went to other surrounding nations like Edom, Moab, and Ammon. So they were scattered, but there was also a remnant left behind in Jerusalem after the burning of the city in 586. Jeremiah was with this remnant. It was at first led by Gedaliah, and then after Gedaliah was killed by Ishmael of Nethaniah, Yohanan son of Korea took over, and that is all told to us in the last few chapters of Jeremiah. So that is who is being referred to here by these few strands of hair that were tucked away in the folds of Ezekiel's garments. So let's look at a brief history of these people who were left behind, these strands of hair, these people who were left in the land of Judea by the Babylonian general Nebuzaradan after 586. They were left behind to be vine dressers and husbandmen so they could till the ground. We read in Jeremiah 52, verse 16, "But Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, left some of the poorest of the land to be vine dressers and plowmen." And I've already mentioned, of course, the Jews who fled to Egypt under Jonathan, son of Korea. They took Jeremiah along with them. I don't think Jeremiah was happy about it. We read about that in Jeremiah 43, verses 5 through 7. "But Yohanan, the son of Korea, and all the commanders of the forces took the entire remnant of Judah who had returned from all the nations to which they had been driven away in order to reside in the land of Judah. The men, the women, the children, the king's daughters, and every person that Nebuzaradan, the captain of the bodyguard, had left with Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, and grandson of Shaphan, together with Jeremiah the prophet and Baruch, the son of Neriah, and they entered the land of Egypt, for they did not obey the voice of the Lord, and went in as far as Tapanhes." And so that is the story of some of the remnant that was left behind after the destruction of 586. But we're still not finished with the story because some of that remnant went back into the land of Judah. We read in Jeremiah 44:28, "And those who escape the sword will return out of the land of Egypt to the land of Judah, few in number. Then all the remnant of Judah who have gone to the land of Egypt to reside there will know whose word will stand, mine or theirs." God didn't want them to go to Egypt. They went and they came back very few in number, but they were preserved, and so they are represented by the strands of hair in Ezekiel's garments. Verse 4, again, Yahweh tells Ezekiel in Ezekiel 5, verse 4, "Again, take a few of these, take a few of those few strands of hair that were tucked into Ezekiel's garment, take a few of these and throw them into the fire and burn them up." Well, those few that survived the siege, they got burnt up when they went down to Egypt, except for the few that survived and came back to Judah. So in verse 4, just to summarize, a few of the hairs that were survived, a few of the hairs that were protected in the folds of Ezekiel's garment, that refers to the poor vine dressers and husbandmen who were left behind and who were under Governor Gedaliah. They were thrown into the fire and burned up because there was a civil war when one of Gedaliah's military officers named Ishmael of Nethaniah, having been bribed by the king of Ammon, a gentleman by the name of Balet, this Ishmael of Nethaniah came in and killed Gedaliah. We read about that in Jeremiah 41, verses 1 through 3. "Now it came about in the seventh month that Ishmael, the son of Nethaniah, the son of Elishama, of the royal family and one of the chief officers of the king, along with 10 men, came to Mizpah to Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam. While they were there eating bread together there in Mizpah, Ishmael, the son of Nethaniah, and the 10 men who were with him arose and struck down Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, with the sword, and put to death the one whom the king of Babylon had appointed over the land." In other words, Gedaliah. "Ishmael also struck down all the Jews who were with him," that is with Gedaliah at Mizpah, "and the Chaldeans who were found there, the men of war." So basically, there were a few Jews that were preserved from the 3/3 judgment of the hair. They survive the siege. They are represented by the hair put into the folds of Ezekiel's garments. But even amongst that surviving remnant, a few of those were thrown into the fire, in other words, killed during Ishmael of Nethaniah's rebellion, and they were burnt. But then there's a few of those survivors that went down to Egypt, and they came back to Judah after having been persecuted by the Egyptians. And then God tells Ezekiel at the very end of verse 3, "A fire will spread from there, from that fire that Ezekiel is burning on the clay tablet, a fire will spread from there to the whole house of Israel. Now, what does that mean? John Gill says that the fire that spreads to the whole house of Israel is referring to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70 by the Romans. Here's what Gill says, quote, those that were left in the land and of such who returned from the captivity. That's talking about the 538-37 return from Babylon. Those for whose sins and those of their posterity, the wrath of God came forth upon all the house of Israel to the utter destruction of the nation, city, and temple by Titus Vespasian. That should be by Titus and Vespasian, his son, or Vespasian and his son Titus. Well, that could be the spreading fire. There's another option. We could take the fire that spreads. The original fire was the murder of Gedaliah. And then after the murder of Gedaliah, judgment came upon the house of Israel because of the war that was between Ishmael, son of Nethaniah, and Johanan, the son of Kareah. So I don't think all of this is entirely clear where this fire spread from, but it's clear that in general it refers to the survivors of the 586 siege. That wasn't going to be the end of it. The survivors themselves were going to be judged. And again, they were in Jerusalem. They had to flee to Egypt. Now you can take the fire spreading from there all the way to the destruction in AD 70, as John Gill does. But I have a little problem with that, because there's the return from Babylon, which is a glorious thing, a type of the entry into the kingdom of God in the New Testament church under Jesus the Messiah. And so if you take that fire spreading to the whole house of Israel as including that period, it sort of ruins the continuity of the destruction. So I'm just going to take it as the survivors survive the three-thirds judgment, I'll call it. There's a few of them that survive it, but then some of them are going to get burnt too. And that would refer to the pitiful rump left behind in Jerusalem, who are also judged when they go down to Egypt. We go now to Ezekiel 5, verses 5 through 9. This is what the Sovereign Lord says. This is Jerusalem, which I have set in the center of the nations, with countries all around her. Yet in her wickedness she has rebelled against my laws and decrees more than the nations and countries around her. She has rejected my laws and has not followed my decrees. Therefore, this is what the Sovereign Lord says. You have been more unruly than the nations around you and have not followed my decrees or kept my laws. You have not even conformed to the standards of the nations around you. Therefore, this is what the Sovereign Lord says. I myself am against you, Jerusalem, and I will inflict punishment on you in the sight of the nations. Because of all your detestable idols, I will do to you what I have never done before and will never do again. Now in verse 5, God says, this is Jerusalem. He's referring to the city that was drawn on the tile mentioned in the previous chapter. This is Jerusalem. I have set Jerusalem in the center of the nations. Now that could be geographically centered or spiritually centered or both. Let's look at what Jameson Fawcett Brown says to push forward the claim that Jerusalem was the geographical center of the world then. Quote, no center in the ancient heathen world could have been selected more fitted than Canaan to be a vantage ground whence the people of God might have acted with success upon the heathenism of the world. It lay midway between the oldest and most civilized states, Egypt and Ethiopia on one side, and Babylon, Nineveh, and India on the other, and afterwards Persia, Greece, and Rome. And if you think about it, that's exactly true. All the great empires of the ancient world form a wheel, if you will, a circumference all around Jerusalem, right in the middle of all that. The Phoenician mariners were close by, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown continue, through whom they might have transmitted the true religion to the remotest lands, and all around the Ishmaelites, that's the Arabs, the great inland traders in South Asia and North Africa. Israel was thus placed not for its own selfish good, but to be the spiritual benefactor of the whole world. So basically, James Fawcett Brown says that Jerusalem is not only geographically the center of the world, but also spiritually too. So God has set Jerusalem in the center of the nations. That's the good news. That's what God has done for Jerusalem. But how has Jerusalem repaid God? Verse 6, she has rebelled in her wickedness against God's laws more than any other nation and countries around her. She has rejected my laws, has not followed my decrees, so you've been more unruly than all the nations around you, and you have not even conformed to the standards of the nations around you. Not even means even the degraded standards of morality and justice that were exhibited by Israel's pagan neighbors. those degraded standards were higher than those of Jerusalem. That's pretty bad. I mean, the ancient world was not exactly noted for its morality. And so God says in verse 8, I'm going to punish you, Jerusalem, in the sight of the nations. He had to do it in the sight of the nations because people had to see God's justice. God didn't want people to think that such crimes committed by the people of Jerusalem would go unanswered and unrequited because the people of Jerusalem were claiming that Yahweh was their God. They were besmirching the honor of their God, the God who had chosen them to be foremost among the nations and the center of the nations. So the judgment had to be done in the sight of the nations. Verse 9, because of all your detestable idols, I will do to you what I have never done before and will never do again. Now verse 9 gives us a little bit of a problem if we want to take that literally. But before I do that, let's just take in generally what it means. The judgment in 586 on Jerusalem trumps any other judgment done against any other pagan nation. It trumps Noah's flood. It trumps Sodom and Gomorrah. It trumps the 10 plagues on Egypt. It trumps the destruction of the Canaanites in Canaan. That's basically what God is saying is going to happen to Jerusalem. But now we have a problem if we want to take this literally. I will do to you what I have never done before and never done again. Well, Jerusalem had never been destroyed before, but will never do again. Jerusalem was destroyed in the future. In AD 70, the famous destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans, and then in AD 135, when the Roman Emperor Hadrian destroyed the Bar Kokhba revolt, AD 136. So how do we handle that problem? Well, I have culled 5 possible solutions to the problem from my commentators, or at least from 4 of them, or at least 4 of the solutions came from the commentators, but I'm going to give my solution, which I think is much better. First suggested solution, this is from John Gill, when God says he will never do again such punishment on Jerusalem, the never again means not for a long time. Well, I don't know, never doesn't sound like a long time, but of course, I don't know Hebrew, and Gil knows Hebrew a lot better than me, so maybe that's reasonable. I would have to check that out. Option number 2, the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70 by the Romans and in AD 136 by the Roman Emperor Hadrian were included in this prophecy. In other words, when God has finished judging Jerusalem, there never will be anything to match it done by the Lord. In other words, I will do to you by destroying you in 586 BC, 70 AD, and 136 AD. Once I finish doing that, it will never be done again. Now that's the solution suggested by Gill and Poole. Let me read you from Adam Clark, who also has the same idea. He says, the destruction of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar was one of the greatest calamities that ever fell on any nation or place before. That's not the problem. Never will be done before. Yep, Jerusalem never was destroyed before 586 in such a fashion. But now, Clark continues, in that the destruction by the Romans under Titus in AD 70 exceeded all that has ever taken place since. These 2 sackages of that city have no parallel in the history of mankind. So Clark just runs the 2 destructions together. He doesn't mention 136 under Hadrian. But the 2 big ones, 586 BC and 70 AD, he does mention and says that never again will anything like that happen to Jerusalem. I guess that's reasonable. But I don't think that's right. Poole says this, though the old world perished by water, and the judgment was greater in its extent, and Sodom was destroyed by fire, yet neither one or other was so lingering a death. These poor Jews were long dying and felt themselves dying. Read the Lamentations as commentary on this text, or Josephus' Wars of the Jews. So Poole mentions both Lamentations, which refers to 586 BC, and he mentions Josephus, which refers to AD 70. I have a problem with that solution because it doesn't sound like Ezekiel is talking about way off in the future in AD 70 and AD 136. The whole context is about the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 BC. The prophecies are looking forward 5 or 6 years to Nebuchadnezzar coming in and destroying Jerusalem. And so we're all into that context, and all of a sudden we're jumping up to 80, 70, and 136. I don't think so. Not in my humble opinion. So let's go to option number 3. This is Ellicott's solution. He says that those things which were done to Jerusalem before and after, such things were never done before or afterwards to the Gentiles. So we would read verse 9 this way: because of all your detestable idols, I will do to you what I have never done before to the Gentiles and will never do again to the Gentiles. In other words, you Jews have managed to suffer a punishment greater than has ever been done before or afterwards to the Gentiles. It's clever, but I don't think that's what Ezekiel meant. Option number 4. This is Poole. He says that no other destruction before or since had such a lingering death. In other words, in verse 9, Ezekiel says, or Yahweh says, I will do to you what I've never done before. There's never been such a lingering death as a city died. It took 30 months for the city to die. The Babylonian siege lasted 30 months. That's never been done before and will never be done again. In AD 70, it didn't take 30 months for the city to die. I don't know. I would question that, though, because the war started roughly around 3.5 years before AD 70. 66 AD is when it started. So it took a long time to go down, too. So I think Poole's suggestion there is no good. Now, here's my solution. This expression, I will do to you what I have never done before and will never do again, is Hebrew hyperbole. It's not meant to be taken literally. I can give you an example. Matthew 24:21. Jesus is speaking in his Olivet Discourse to 3 of his disciples, and he says, for then there will be a great tribulation, such as has not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever shall. Now, I'm assuming that this is referring to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. If you want to be a left behind dispensationalist pre-trib futurist, well, okay, take it that way. It doesn't really matter how you take the great tribulation. If you say that that great tribulation, no such tribulation has ever occurred before, what about Noah's flood? That wiped out the whole earth. Even the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, as bad as it wasn't bad as wiping out the whole earth. And if you take the great tribulation as referred to the great tribulation at the end under the Antichrist and all that kind of stuff, the whole earth wasn't wiped out, just some bad times. So you can't take Matthew 24:21 literally. This is Hebrew hyperbole. We see an example of that in Daniel 9:12. He, that's God, has carried out his words that he spoke against us and against our rulers by bringing on us so great a disaster that nothing like what has been done to Jerusalem has ever been done under all of heaven. That's again talking about AD 70. Well, I don't know. What about Noah's flood? Jebus, Jerusalem was around a long time ago. I assume it was around not under the Jews, but under the Jebusites. He got wiped out by Noah's flood. So again, you get yourself in trouble when you take metaphors and hyperbole and take them literally. We go now to Ezekiel 5:10. God continues, therefore, in your midst, fathers will eat their children, and children will eat their fathers. I will inflict punishment on you and will scatter all your survivors to the winds. Now, I'm going to give you a lot of examples, both prophesied and actual, where mothers ate their children. Doesn't say fathers, but we can assume fathers did it too. The mothers are mentioned particularly because there's a special connection between a mother and her children, a connection that sort of trumps the connection between a father and his children. And so the idea is, if a mother would do that, if even a mother would do that, certainly a father would do it too. Now, this eating of children in case of disobedience to God's law was long ago threatened by the Lord. It was prophesied of by Moses. We read in the curses chapters in the law, Leviticus 26:27-29. Yet, if in spite of this, you do not obey me, but act with hostility against me, then I will act with wrathful hostility against you. And I, even I, will punish you 7 times for your sins. Further, you shall eat the flesh of your sons, and the flesh of your daughters you shall eat. That, of course, would only happen during sieges. Deuteronomy 28:53-57. Again, in the curses section of the law, another section. Then you shall eat the offspring of your own body, the flesh of your sons and of your daughters, whom the Lord your God has given you, during the siege and the distress by which your enemy shall oppress you. The man who is refined and very delicate among you shall be hostile toward his brother and toward the wife he cherishes and toward the rest of his children who remain, so that he will not give even one of them any of the flesh of his children which he shall eat, since he has nothing else left. During the siege and the distress by which your enemy shall oppress you in all your towns, the refined and delicate woman among you, who would not venture to set the sole of her foot on the ground for delicateness and refinement, shall be hostile toward the husband she cherishes, and toward her son and daughter, and toward her afterbirth, which issues from between her legs, and toward her children whom she bears, for she shall eat them secretly for lack of anything else, during the siege and the distress by which her enemy shall oppress you in your towns. Now, of course, this was fulfilled in the destruction of Jerusalem in 586, also in AD 70 by the Romans. It actually was fulfilled at several times in the history of the people of Israel. There was a siege of Samaria, the capital of the northern kingdom. During a war between Syria and northern Israel, in 2 Kings 6:28, we read this, "And the king said to her, 'What is the matter with you?' And she answered, 'This woman said to me, "Give your son that we may eat him today, and we will eat my son tomorrow.'" Little dispute over the fact that the first son got eaten, but the second son wasn't handed over for dinner. So there was an example of the law and its curses being fulfilled by cannibalism, parental cannibalism. How about the siege of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar? We read in Lamentations 4:10, "The hands of compassionate women boiled their own children." Now, Lamentations is poetry written by Jeremiah talking about the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 after the fact. So this is history now, not prophecy. "The hands of compassionate women boiled their own children. They became food for them because of the destruction of the daughter of my people." And then, of course, the siege of Jerusalem by Titus, and the destruction of the city in AD 70 by Titus, the Roman general. Josephus relates a very famous story about a woman who ate her children. Now, this story is so famous that it has its own special entry in Wikipedia. Mary of Bethusabah. She has a name. So let me read you from this excerpt from Josephus. Josephus relates that there was a Mary, daughter of Eleazar, originally from the village of Bethusabah in the district of Priah, east of the Jordan River, who had previously fled to Jerusalem. Distinguished in family and fortune, her property, treasures, and food had been plundered by the Jewish defenders of the city during the siege. Famine was eating her heart out and rage consuming her still faster. Maddened by hunger, she took the infant at her breast and said to him, "Poor little mite, in war, famine, and civil strife, why should I keep you alive? With the Romans there is only slavery, and that only if alive when they come. But famine is forestalling slavery, and the partisans are crueler than ever." The partisans are the Jewish people who are crazy. "Come, you must be food for me, to the partisans an avenging spirit, and to the world a tale." She has become a tale. We're hearing that story even today, almost 2 millennia later. "So you must be food for me, to the partisans an avenging spirit, and to the world a tale, the only thing left to fill up the measure of Jewish misery," she says to her little baby. And in defiance to all natural feeling, she killed her son, then roasted him and ate one half, hiding the rest, leftovers. Almost immediately the rebels appeared, sniffing the unholy smell, and threatened to kill her on the spot unless she revealed what she had prepared. They were hungry. They smelled the food. They said, "Ooh, this smells good. We want some food." As she uncovered what was left of the child, she offered them a share. They left her in horror, and the entire city could not stop thinking of this crime and abomination. When the news reached the Romans, some refused to believe. Some were distressed, but on most the effect was to add enormously to their detestation of the enemy at hand. Quite a dramatic passage from Josephus. Here's another relevant scripture. This is a prophecy in Jeremiah 19:9. He's prophesying, of course, of the 586 destruction of Jerusalem. He says, "I will make them eat the flesh of their sons." This is God speaking. "I will make them eat the flesh of their sons and their daughters, and they will eat each other's flesh in the siege and distress that their enemies," those who want to take their life, "inflict on them." So in Ezekiel 5, verse 10, the fact that God predicts that there will be parental cannibalism is no surprise. Now, there is one mentioned here in verse 10 that children will eat their fathers, and I was not able to find any historical reference to that actually happening. I can speculate that a father might have died from hunger or gotten stabbed or something and killed, and the kid is so hungry he cooks his father in order to stay alive. Now, when you're talking about situations that are so dire and unimaginable, this is imaginable, that a child would eat his father's. I'm sure they did. Now, at the end of verse 10, God says that he is going to scatter all of the survivors of this horrible siege to the wind. So survivors were carried into Babylon, of course. But also, I'm sure some of them fled, went to Egypt, Ammon, Moab, Edom, surrounding nations. We go now to Ezekiel 5, verses 11 through 17. Yahweh continues, "Therefore, as surely as I live, declares the Sovereign Lord, because you have defiled my sanctuary with all your vile images and detestable practices, I myself will withdraw my favor. I will not look on you with pity or spare you. A third of your people will die of the plague or perish by famine inside you. A third will fall by the sword outside your walls. And a third I will scatter to the winds and pursue them with drawn sword. Then my anger will cease and my wrath against them will subside, and I will be avenged. And when I have spent my wrath upon them, they will know that I, the Lord, have spoken in my zeal. I will make you a ruin and a reproach among the nations around you in the sight of all who pass by. You will be a reproach and a taunt, a warning and an object of horror to the nations around you when I inflict punishment on you in anger and in wrath and with stinging rebuke. I, the Lord, have spoken. When I shoot at you with my deadly and destructive arrows of famine, I will shoot to destroy you. I will bring more and more famine upon you and cut off your supply of food. I will send famine and wild beasts against you, and they will leave you childless. Plague and bloodshed will sweep through you, and I will bring the sword against you. I, the Lord, have spoken." Now in verse 11, God takes an oath. He swears by himself because he can't swear by anything higher than himself. He says, "As surely as I live," that is a well-known Old Testament oath because it's pretty sure that God lives, "declares the Sovereign Lord, because you have defiled my sanctuary." Now it's one thing to put idols up on a mountain, on a hill, in a grove somewhere, but to put idols into God's holy temple, "you have defiled my sanctuary." Now, when had that happened? Well, Manasseh did it. Manasseh ruled from 687 to 642 in the southern kingdom of Judah. He built altars for Baal in the house of the Lord. He set up in the temple a graven image, graven images that were normally put into groves. We read that in 2 Kings 21, verses 3 through 4. He, that's Manasseh, rebuilt the high places that his father Hezekiah had destroyed and reestablished the altars for Baal. He made an Asherah, as King Ahab of Israel had done. He also worshipped the whole heavenly host and served them. He built altars in the Lord's temple, where the Lord had said, "Jerusalem is where I will put my name." 2 Kings 21, verse 7, Manasseh set up the carved image of Asherah, which he made in the temple, that the Lord had spoken about to David and his son Solomon, "I will establish my name forever in this temple in Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel." In both those scriptural passages, we'll see the contrast between where or what was put in the temple and how holy that temple was to God. Jerusalem is where I will put my name. I will establish my name forever in this temple and in Jerusalem. And that's where you put your idols, Manasseh. It's no wonder Jerusalem got wiped out. And so God in verse 11 is referring back to what Manasseh had done. He put vile images, detestable practices, I guess those are priestly practices, in serving the vile idols. So God will withdraw his favor. He won't pity or spare Jerusalem. And then in verse 12, he summarizes the thirds of hair. "A third of your people will die of the plague." That was the third of the hair that was burnt on the city on the clay tablet. And that third refers to plague and famine, dying from plague and famine. "A third," that's the second third, "will fall by a sword outside your walls." That's the people who are fighting the Babylonian invasion, most probably. "And a third I will scatter to the winds." That would be the exile to Babylon and, of course, fleeing to other nations around Jerusalem also at the same time. "I will scatter the third to the winds and pursue with a drawn sword." In other words, you can run, but God's still angry. He's got a sword after you. Then in verse 13, God's anger will cease and wrath against the exiles will subside and against the people of Jerusalem will subside. "And I will be avenged." In other words, the vengeance has been taken. It's over. And then God will show mercy. He doesn't mention it here, but what happens is there's a remnant that returned from Babylon in 538, 537 BC or so after the Babylonians are captured by the Persians. Verse 13, "When I have spent my wrath upon the people of Jerusalem, they will know that I, the Lord, have spoken in my zeal." I guess they should know that after what happened. It was pretty bad. Verse 14, God says, "I will make you a ruin and a reproach among the nations." This is recorded in Lamentations 2, verses 15 through 16. Jeremiah says this, "All who pass along the way clap their hands in derision at you, Jerusalem. They hiss and shake their heads at the daughter of Jerusalem. The daughter is the population of Jerusalem. Is this the city of which they said, the perfection of beauty, a joy to all the earth? All your enemies have opened their mouths wide against you. They hiss and gnash their teeth. They say, we have swallowed her up. Surely this is the day for which we waited. We have reached it and we have seen it. So Jerusalem in verse 15 is said to be made an object of horror to the nations. The nations need to see this because they need to see that if you turn away from the God who created the universe and who chose Israel as a chosen nation, you rebel against that and you've rebelled against the great light and bad things happen. God's name needed to be vindicated, his good name. His good name had been destroyed by the terrible witness of God's chosen people. Now backing up a little bit in verse 12, God says a third of your people will die of the plague. There's no account of people dying of the plague in the siege of Jerusalem in 586, but we can be sure it happened because that's what always happens. Public health breaks down when people get hungry. There is an account of the famine that happened in 586 B.C. In 2 Kings 25:3, we read this, by the ninth day of the fourth month, the famine was so severe in the city that the people of the land had no food. Where there's famine, plague naturally follows. One other little comment before I leave this audio. Verse 13, when God's anger subsides, that would presumably be after the Babylonian captivity, which is said to be 70 years. We read in Zechariah 1, verses 12, then the angel of the Lord answered and said, O Lord of hosts, how long wilt thou have no compassion for Jerusalem and the cities of Judah, with which thou hast been indignant these 70 years? Now those are the famous 70 years of Jeremiah mentioned by Zechariah. The date range is much controverted, but I assume it's from 609, the Battle of Haran, when Babylon became the top dog in the ancient Near East and wiped out the remnants of Assyria, till 539 when Babylon was defeated by Persia and the Jews were let go. 70 years, the numbers add up. Why make it complicated? Now it's true that the exile was not exactly for 70 years, but the prophecy was, if you go back and look at it, it's the prophecy that Babylon would be in the ascendant. It didn't say that the Jews would be in exile, but that Babylon would be the top dog, in which case 609 works perfectly. And that's how I'm going to take it in my present stage of ignorance. Ladies and gentlemen, with these awful imprecations against the people of Judah, famine, wild beast, leaving you childless, plague, bloodshed, sword, we are now ready to go to our next chapter, Ezekiel chapter 6, which I will entitle Judgment Against Idolatry. Doom and gloom. Oh, but God, he's just a happy grandfather up there on a sofa just throwing out bonbons to his children down here, and he'll forgive us all, whether we ask for forgiveness or not, because he's just a loving God. He doesn't punish sin. Well, we'll see about that in the next chapter. I hope you stay with me, and I hope you enjoyed the discussion of chapter 5.